Thank you for listening to this Podcast One production. Available on Apple Podcasts and Podcast One.
Your life, your country. You're listening to the Laura Ingraham Podcast.
Trump was right and the so-called experts wrong. What am I talking about? Remember in 2017 when the president announced that we were going to have, at the very least, a temporary pause on immigration and refugees from a list of countries. Initially, it was a longer list, but it ended up being, what, six, seven countries? It wasn't all that many countries. And we'll just remind you of what the critics were saying.
What the president has done is not in the interest of security. It is reckless. It is reckless and rash to protect our Constitution and our people. We must be strong and smart.
The reason I oppose the specific thing that President Trump did was the following. Refugees have the most stringent vetting of all newcomers to our country. The most stringent vetting.
Oh,
so we're not casual about our reasons to, our need to protect the American people. But we have to be strong and we have to be smart. We don't have to be reckless and rash.
Well, that's not all that helpful. Let's go to Elizabeth Warren, by golly, in January 2017.
Let's all be clear. President Trump's order has nothing to do with security.
That's right.
Students, teachers, people who work right here in Massachusetts are not a threat to the United States.
Right.
How about Mustafa Alawamer? Syrian refugee allowed into the country in the last months of the Obama administration in the fall of 2016. And thanks to the great work of the FBI, he was thwarted in his attempt to carry out a terrorist attack against a Christian worship center in Pittsburgh. We first broke this news on Fox on Wednesday night. We'll have a lot more as the details come in, but just that one detail is key. Arrested on terrorism charges after he was allegedly planning to attack the Legacy International Worship Center on the north side. 21 years old, admitted to the U.S. as a refugee from Syria. Raymond Arroyo is with us from Fox and EWTN. And Raymond, I have so many friends, as do you, who do work in the beleaguered and much diminished Christian community in Iraq and Syria. They can't get into the United States as refugees. They pose no threat
Correct.
To the United States, at least no serious threat. They were our allies. They helped us in doing interpreting in very dangerous places. They're true refugee candidates. And yet this is the type of person we're letting in.
Well, I should say. It is incumbent upon the administration to start vetting people based on their beliefs and their orientation toward the United States as well. Now, look, refugee status, there's a whole host of issues that go to qualifying as a refugee. But when you're talking about Christian refugees from this area, they are caught between a rock and a hard place. There's nowhere for them to go. And their homeland is literally being squished and they're being pushed from it. So they should be given priority. And you'll remember the president early on said, we will give priority to these Christian refugees. But then because of legal obstacles and protocols, that becomes difficult to prioritize without it looking like sectarianism, like you're supporting people just because of their faith. So, but there has to be some standard here. And Christian persecution, because of its genocidal side effects, should be taken into consideration. And this is an example of what you don't want to happen.
Mustafa Alawamer, who, of course, was a refugee from Syria, is facing one count of attempting to provide material support and resources to the Islamic State and Al-Sham, which is another terrorist organization, two counts of distributing information related to an explosive, a destructive device, or mass weapon of destruction. Targeting places of worship is beyond the pale, said the Assistant Attorney General Demers. The defendant is alleged to have plotted such an attack of a church in Pittsburgh in the name of ISIS. And they're going to continue to identify others because it's never just one. This is not a one-off. These people all live in communities, just like whether it was the 9/11 attackers or they come from an extremist mosque and a radical place of worship, or that allows radical views to be discussed and sold to its congregants. Of course, the agents and analysts who made this arrest possible. It was a joint FBI Pittsburgh task force working with Washington. He had plotted to place a bomb inside the church, was inspired by ISIS. Well, we're not even talking about what happened and 340 people dead in Sri Lanka during a Good Friday. Was it Good Friday services or was it Easter Sunday? I can't remember.
Easter Sunday.
Easter Sunday services. That just, you notice how no one's talking about that anymore? Whatever happened to that? Did they make a lot of arrests? Are people going to be subject to capital punishment or life in prison? I mean, it seems like these stories happen and then they're just gone. And no one connects the dots here. ICE is detaining 10 people in North Alabama after a traffic stop uncovers a smuggling operation. This is also very curious. The smuggling of people, just a topic we're going to get into with our next guest, has increased during this period of catch and release for obvious reasons. But they bring them in large groups, oftentimes in tractor trailers, or they cross the border. Then they hook up and they meet up, and have pre-designed, preset meetup places with smugglers who then send them across the country to work in various illicit trades, whether it's working without paying taxes, whether it's working in the drug trade, working in the sex trade. This is how it's worked. So they found a whole bunch of people, 10 illegal aliens, found inside this stopped vehicle. And authorities said the bus was connected to a human smuggling operation and that the people detained were from Salvador, Ecuador, that's a long way from home, and Guatemala. This is another great job by our interdiction team. But, I mean, that's like pulling one petal out of a huge flower garden. You know, that's just, or weed, I should say, a weed out of a huge flower garden. There's always going to be another one. Joining us now is Deputy Director of ICE, Matt Albence. He's going to give us some sense of what the president's tweet meant the other day of deporting millions of people who are in this country illegally. Do we have any better sense of what that means and how the send back to Mexico policy will actually be carried out and enforced? Director Albence, good to talk to you. How are you, my friend?
Good morning. Thanks for having me, Laura.
So tell me where we are on first the return to Mexico pending asylum adjudication agreement that the United States and Mexico came to because of pressure put on Mexico by this administration.
Yeah, so we started that program earlier this year. As a result of the recent negotiation and agreement, we've been able to ramp up the numbers within that program. Obviously, if we are only able to return a small number, its effectiveness is going to be limited. As we're able to increase the numbers, as we have been able to do since this agreement, we're finding it's going to be much more effective, and we've seen a little bit of reduced flow over the border over the past week.
So we saw that Mexico had stepped up interdiction on its side of the border, 800 people in one tractor trailer, or two tractor trailer stops. They're putting more manpower on its own southern border. But as far as the people who, and I know this is Border Patrol, it's not ICE, but those people who are crossing the border and turning themselves in, including family units, which is what we saw during our days in the Eagle Pass in the Del Rio sector, are those people being processed at the centers, as far as you understand, and then being immediately returned to Mexico? Because we just saw them by the busload being released.
Yeah, so that's something we're working on with the new expansion. That's something we've been able to get Mexico to agree with. And it's true. Unfortunately, we've released over 207,000 family units just since December 21st of last year. So with the inability to hold them during the pendency of the immigration process because of the Flores settlement agreement, we have no choice but to release them. And so Congress has failed to act to fix that and has created a cottage industry for human smuggling and trafficking, which is why we're seeing these children being recycled over and over again with unrelated adults just for the sole purpose of them making that illegal entry, knowing full well they'll be released.
The people who've been ordered deported, who are deportable aliens. They have not shown up for their deportation proceedings. They've already been adjudged by an immigration court, inadmissible alien. I used to actually, and for a very short period of time, practice this law, so I know it pretty well. Those individuals number in the several hundred thousand, Director Albenz?
Well, right now we have 570,000 immigration fugitives. These are individuals, to your point, who have availed themselves of all due process, have gone through the court system, and at the end of that process, an immigration judge has ordered them removed, and they failed to comply with that removal order. So
570,000.
At least 570,000. It grows every day. And there's possibly a million out there on the non-detained docket with orders of removal as well.
So that could be, I mean, is that what the president is referencing in this tweet then? Is that the group? Or is he conflating that group with the people who will be turned back to Mexico? Do we know?
Well, I'm not sure exactly what he was getting to in the tweet. What I can tell you is that we are asserting resources to go after fugitives. Fugitives have always been an enforcement priority for us. Yeah. We'll continue to go after fugitives. Just so happens that now, as a result of what we're seeing with the family units, we are having increased numbers of family units that are fugitives that we're going after. But it's not unique. In 2014 and 2015, when the problem first started, we ran operations to go after family units, try to, one, not only uphold the validity of those immigration warrants and removal orders from the judge and restore some integrity to the immigration system, but also try to reduce that pull factor. It's, you know, human nature tells you if you continue to reward illegal behavior, you're going to get more of it.
And more illegal behavior.
As long as we continue to allow people to come to this country illegally, game the system with these fake family units and not show for court, knowing that the chances of being arrested at the end of that process being small, we're going to get more of that. We're going to have those pull factors, which will create more pressure on the border.
So it's a twofold process here. I mean, twofold in the goals. Restore the integrity of the rule of law that reduces the incentive for people to cross the border, and obviously just enforce the rule of law here at home and make sure that, you know, people understand that when we have laws, they're actually enforced. You can't break the laws. Correct. Otherwise, nobody has. Why should anyone abide by any laws if they don't have to abide by these laws? Why does any American have to abide by any law?
Well, correct. And the taxpayer puts in billions of dollars a year into the immigration court system, into this agency, for the sole purpose of enforcing the laws. We only enforce the laws that Congress has passed. So when an individual goes to an immigration judge, and if they claim asylum and the judge upholds that asylum claim and gives that person that benefit and gives them asylum status in this country, those individuals are free and clear. We respect and we honor that decision by a judge. The same thing has to apply when somebody is ordered removed by an immigration judge. If we only uphold the judge's order when it benefits the alien, then we have no system and we'll have a complete breakdown of the rule of law.
When the president released his tweet, there were reports that there were up to a million people with deportation orders on them. Do you believe that figure to be accurate?
It is. There's about 900 to a million people on the non-detained docket with removal orders. Some of those individuals are still in the appeals process, so they would not be ready to be arrested right now. But those are ones that, once that appeal process is done, and if they lose that appeal, that we would take enforcement action against.
So, but there's 570,000 who are deportable aliens now.
Well, and those are deportable because they've already had their hearing.
Full due process.
Judge. We've got hundreds of thousands of other individuals, if not millions, that are here illegally that are also deportable, whether just for the immigration violations or in addition to the criminal history. So we arrested over 105,000 convicted criminals last year just by our fugitive operations teams in ICE alone. 10,000 of those were gang members.
Wow. And they keep saying, oh, the president's just making this up. This is Eddie Gloud.
I'm not making up. This is my day-to-day reality. It's not being made up.
Yeah, I know. This is what you do. I mean, believe me, I spent so much time with the Border Patrol people and the ICE agents that I've had the great privilege of getting to know over the last many years. And I just, my heart bleeds for them. I mean, they just want to do their job. Don't be demonized. Don't demonize them. Don't call them terrorists. It's so despicable, and it shouldn't be political at all. This is a Princeton professor, Director Albenz, named Eddie Gloud Jr. Sorry to torture you with this, but let's listen.
What Donald Trump did yesterday, what he announced via Twitter, and this may sound hyperbolic to some folk, it was a terroristic act. He's terrorizing families in communities who think that they're going to be snatched away from their kids, who have to walk around daily wondering whether an ICE agent is going to show up at work and snatch them.
Again, it's all the emotional appeals to people. These are people working in our communities, in our restaurants, in our lawn care companies. These are all the people who we know they're in our schools. They're also violating U.S. law.
Right. We don't arrest people that are here in the country legally. Our dedicated men and women do a tremendous job under tremendous scrutiny in the most difficult of conditions. And as you know, having practiced immigration law, it's incredibly complex. And they do an outstanding job with very little support from Congress, both in terms of resources and, you know, making those changes to the immigration laws that we've requested that would help solve some of these problems.
We're talking about Deputy Director.
I don't think, I mean, I've been federal government for 25 years. There's no more resilient bunch of hardworking, dedicated, patriotic government servants than here within ICE.
And I know you, ICE is not political. Everyone has to understand this. This is, they're not working with regard to political party. There's no loyalty to the Democrats. Everyone has, I'm sure, their own political views. But they, you know, the folks I meet say, hey, I'm not, I'm just giving you the facts. I'm telling you what's worked, what strategies work and bring numbers down, and what strategies have exploded numbers. And I will ask you this, the drumbeat on the cables that we've been hearing, cable networks, other than Fox for the most part, are individuals saying the following. Donald Trump created the crisis at the border by saying he was going to get tough on the border. Do you see that that is what the pull to the border is in the year 2019?
No, I would lay the bulk of the problem right on the hills of on the steps of Capitol Hill. The reason these people are coming is because we, under the current legal framework, are unable to exact any sort of consequence for individuals' illegal behavior. So when we can't hold family units, and they know that they bring a child here, whether it's their child or someone that they bought, a kid that they bought for $50 or rented for $50 the day before in Matamoros, and bring that kid across the country, and that within 24 to 72 hours, they're going to be released to the streets of this country with no, very little chance of being apprehended, then of course it's going to be behavior that gets repeated and repeated. There is no disincentive to illegal entry if we don't enforce the laws here in the interior of the United States. I will tell you this, Laura. Anybody that says that you can have strong border security without a corresponding strong interior enforcement knows nothing about what they're talking about. You cannot have one without the other. As long as you don't have strong interior enforcement, there will be people that will continue to put pressure upon that border and try to get past the Border Patrol, or in some cases just turn themselves in like these family units, and you will never, ever secure that border without strong interior enforcement. Congress should fix this in a day if they fix some of the loopholes that are out there.
Deputy Director Al Benz, come on Fox soon. Incredibly persuasive, informative. And we just need to hear as much as we can from you, the entire country. And it's just incredibly elucidating for all of us. We really appreciate it. Thank you so much for spending some time with us today.
Thanks for having me.
All right. You're listening to the Laura Ingraham Podcast. Let's go to Carl in Virginia. Carl, go ahead. Nice to have you on.
Hello. Hello, Laura. I was listening to your previous, and what I hear him saying is there are, It's like a little bit of butter on a big piece of bread. They are not able to keep up with what's going on. And this Syrian refugee that was granted legal entry was not vetted properly, because we give the Reader's Digest version of vetting because there's so many refugees at this point.
Well, there's no vetting. How do you vet in a country like Syria? This is why Trump did exactly what he needed to do. There are countries that cannot be trusted to follow protocol. And I think given the huge assimilation problems we're having, especially with those coming from very different cultures than ours, especially given the sheer numbers of people we've taken in, I think we have to take a real pause on this massive influx of people into this country. We have to, it's not that we shouldn't take anyone in, but we have to be super, super strict about who comes in right now. We just have to be. Japan has always been very strict. Sweden is getting stricter. The people are outraged, even in that liberal country, about what's happened with the refugees that Merkel let into the EU. They're just drowning in problems in Sweden. And the United States just has to be super careful. This is a beautiful, wonderful country, and we want people who are going to add to it and fit in with our values and our overall general beliefs that we live in a good country. The problem is we have a lot of people already here who don't think we live in a good country, but who think the country is racist and the country stole land, and you're living on stolen land, and you got to do reparations and all this other stuff, and you got to deface statues and rip them down, and you know, this is just a mess. We're dealing with a total breakdown in the values of this country that I grew up in, and it's just disgusting. We're normalizing vandalism, we're normalizing illegality, and then we're using Holocaust analogies to describe rightful law enforcement and border enforcement operations. That's another thing, which I don't even want to give you-know-who any publicity today, because I had enough from her. A lot of people in the summertime, you know, feel like your skin is not what it could be. I mean, if you're like me, you put sunblock on, and that's really good. You should do that every day, no matter where you're going. Put on a good sunblock. That's just not on your face, but on your arms, anything where the sun is showing on. But also, as you get older, you get, you know, lines that, you know, you wish weren't there, especially along your jawline. And that's where my friends at Chamonix come in, because they have a great Genucel jawline cream, which I've used now for a couple of years. I've used the under eye for bags and puffiness longer, but the jawline treatment is a clean, incredibly natural, you know, effective product that you'll see the results from very quickly. And if you don't, because it has the Chamonix MDL technology, if you don't, then guess what? You get your 100% of your money back. That's just a great, great guarantee. And I promise you, you'll love it. So you text now. And the classic Genucel for bags and puffiness, that clear liquid, clear gel that you use under your eyes that I use, you get that for free just for trying the jawline cream. So it's very easy. All you do is text the word eyes, and the number one, to 77453. Or go to Genucel.com. You can do it there, too. And you're going to get two free gifts and free shipping when you order that jawline cream. Again, text eyes1 to 77453 or go to Genucel.com.
I do not believe in reparation, because what reparation does, it points to a certain race, a certain color, and it points them as evil, and points the other race, my race, as one that is not only becomes racist, but also beggars.
That was Burgess Owens, of course, former NFL player, and just so inspiring on issues of self-help and individual responsibility, and especially in this time of you know, increased racial animosity and division. It's important to hear his voice. Many others spoke out at this reparations hearing this week that was packed on Capitol Hill. And Dr. Wilfred Riley, he's a professor of political science at Kentucky State University. It's a historically black college. He's author of Hate Crime Hoax, The Left's Campaign to Sell a Fake Race War, came out earlier this year. And he watched the proceedings this week, and we'll have some other sound for him. And he joins us now. Dr. Riley, great to talk to you. Did anything surprise you at this hearing this week?
Not especially. I think the two sides of the reparations argument have been pretty much as they are for probably 40 years. I don't think there's much new to be said about the idea that reparations should be paid for slavery. One side points out that slavery is a foundational evil. The other side points out that we haven't had any slaves in a while. No black person alive in the USA has ever been a slave. Our parents weren't slaves, and so on down the line. So what you saw was essentially a redancing of the same steps we've seen with Ta-Nehisi Coates' piece a few years back, past hearings on this, and so on. So no, nothing really surprised me.
Well, I think what's changed is that this is being mainstreamed. You have most Democrat candidates advocating for some type of reparations, although not all of them in just, you know, sheer money form. And so a lot of them are, you know, just saying, well, the principle is correct. Mitch McConnell described it as America's original sin yesterday, I believe. And he said it was yesterday. And he said, look, we've passed the Civil Rights Act. We've had an African-American president. We've had a lot of improvements in the country, and this just is not workable. And for that, Dr. Riley, oh my gosh, he was trashed by, you know, various people who spoke at this hearing, and we're going to play one of them now.
Majority Leader McConnell cited civil rights legislation yesterday, as well he should, because he was alive to witness the harassment, jailing, and betrayal of those responsible for that legislation by a government sworn to protect them.
Most Democrats.
He was alive for the redlining of Chicago and the looting of black homeowners of some $4 billion. Victims of that plunder are very much alive today. I am sure they'd love a word with the majority leader.
Yeah, Ta-Nehisi Coates. So that was his argument. How would you respond to that?
Well, I think that there, first of all, I think that whether or not you like Senator McConnell, who's a representative of my state and I believe of my district, in fact, Mitch McConnell. Yeah.
Senator. What he said, he's a senator. He's not a congressman. He's a senator. He's not a congressman.
Senator. Obviously, Senator Mitch McConnell is the Senate Majority Leader. But what he said actually was fairly complex. And he pointed out that there are, in essence, a good number of reparative programs that we already have in the USA. So, for example, affirmative action is a reparative program designed to move African Americans forward, whether or not it actually achieved that. He mentioned the Civil Rights Act, which obviously made most forms of racism civilly and sometimes criminally illegal. He went on in this vein for 2 or 3 minutes. I thought his remarks were solid. What's generally happened is that what he said has been sort of chopped up into small segments. So he's often quoted as saying simply, we've had a black president, and so that in and of itself is a form of reparations for slavery. And I don't really think that's what the man said. Yeah. In terms of the main point, the thrust of what Mitch McConnell said, that it would be very difficult to set up a working reparations program, that is true. There are three major problems with reparations, which I would refer to, and I have in my writing, as who gets, who gives, and who's next. So in terms of who receives reparations, is that simply everyone black? Is there a cutoff in terms of quote-unquote percentage of blood there? I mean, my family, I'm half Irish-American, half African-American, a little bit Indian. So if I turned out to be, say, 40% black, would I receive reparation? What if you are black, but you're born overseas? A fair chunk of the U.S. black elite comes from civilized foreign states like Brazil, Nigeria. Would they receive reparations? 12% of African Americans, a figure nearly on par with that for whites, were slave owners historically. Would they receive reparations? Okay, the next line is who pays reparations? Would, if you're talking about something like a tax levy, would black people be taxed? I mean, would I have to pay additional money to give reparations to myself? A bit more broadly, what about the descendants of immigrants who didn't enter the United States until 100 years after slavery? A poignant one, what about the descendants of Union soldiers? And then you get into this discussion, when I say who's next, about whether there is something unique about the African-American case. So what about Native Americans, for example? Would that be the next reparations fight? Obviously, both white and black soldiers, frankly, took this country from the Indians, the first people.
Yeah, well, yeah, people would argue that the whole world, and I would, that the whole world has been reshaped by people taking other people's land. Yeah. I mean, it's called conquest. I mean, it's called, you know, the Ottoman Empire had to shrink back. We had a totally different map throughout Europe and Asia. I mean, that's just the way the world is. I mean, they want to live in a fake world where, I mean, as Trump always says, you don't get do-overs. No do-overs. That's it. And it was there was an argument sometime, I think it was the 1980s, there was a quote, you won, we lost, that's that. Yeah, like around describing world politics. We won, you lost, that's that. That's just what it is. I mean, there's nothing to change that. I mean, you could change the Indian reservations and make them better or change the whole way those that's not my area of expertise, but this is just preposterous. This idea of trying to divide the country up on I guess go through 23andMe and see who's what lineage and what percentage and when did you come here? And I guess come up with an algorithm. Certain people get land and other people get cash and other people get opportunity. Or what is it? And it's going to breed resentment. This is my point. More resentment, less coming together. As other people feel like they're working their butts off and all they are is called racist all day long for working their butts off.
Well, yeah, I actually think that what you just said very specifically is one of the major political issues in the country. And I think that rather than pure old school racism was one of the major reasons for the Trump phenomenon. in that sort of working middle class Americans concentrated in the heartland of the country felt that for the past 50 years, they had been constantly called not only racist, but privileged, which most people I know in Kentucky would find ridiculous of all races, while at the same time being the primary victims of, for example, affirmative action, illegal immigration, actual patterns of cross race and cross social class crime, social collapse. So, yeah, I think that's true. And obviously requiring everyone to take a DNA test if this is the route that we chose to go down, and then paying reparations to those people that were more than 50% black would exacerbate that effect. There actually are a fair number of arguments here. One of the big counters to reparations as well would be simply the question of harm. So obviously, as you know, as an attorney by background, in general, to gain a civil judgment, you have to show that you were somehow harmed by the other party involved. There's a real question as to whether any group in America, whether you're talking about whites from Northern Ireland, Bosnia, Albania, you're talking about blacks from Africa, I mean, the Congo, Benin, Hispanics, obviously, whether any group in America could show that they would be better off if their ancestors hadn't come to the United States. And I think that would be nearly impossible to demonstrate. So obviously, no, slavery was a terrible thing. Slavery was a great evil. But you're right that conquest, aggressive war, wasn't made illegal until after World War II. We're talking about something like 1954 in terms of complete ratification of the Geneva Conventions. Before that, that's just how you got countries. In the show Game of Thrones, it's referred to as paying the iron price. There's a often reasonably honorable war between two groups of people, and the winner gets the land and the people that live on it. That's what we did until we stopped it. So I don't necessarily know if trying to reverse all that history is a logical idea or a good one.
But it won't work. You can't reverse history. I mean, this is the point. They think that by ripping down statues and defacing statues that people are going to somehow feel better. I mean, you just make a lot of people feel worse, and you make a lot of people feel resentful. And like, it's not people's fault that they were born in Georgia during, you know, the Civil War time anymore. It's a fault of someone who comes from this country, come from another country to live here and tries to fit in. I mean, that's who they were, and that's how they were born. And so, like, what are we going to dig up every grave, like Confederate soldier grave, and burn them in some kind of crematorium? I mean, what are we going to do? Like, just bulldoze all those cemeteries. If they are all evil too, each and every one of them was an evil person, then why would we have any cemeteries that have any Confederate soldiers in them? I mean, it's a real, you know, I'm from Connecticut. I was a Connecticut Yankee. So I say this as an American who says, like, we got to put this all in the back, you know, back seat, and try to move forward together as a country, and without regard to race and without regard to, you know, where you came from. Just, what are you going to add to the country? What are you going to bring to the country? Let's show each other what we can do and try to be better to each other. That's it. That's how you get ahead, in my view. We love having you on. Thank you so much. And we always remember that in the end, I think the American people are a lot smarter than these politicians and these activists think that we are. And so we'll continue on these topics and a lot more. You're listening to the Laura Ingraham Podcast. I want you all to remember that when you're thinking about where you're going to give your hard-earned money, if you give money to charity, many of you do, think about incredible organizations that help people and the defenseless creatures among us in need. And I love my dogs. I love the outdoors. And the Delta Animal Rescue is one of the great, great sanctuaries in the world, frankly. It's a no-kill, care-for-life sanctuary. And it's home to more than 1,500 animals. And you can help keep this beautiful mountaintop ranch just going, continuing its mission of compassion by including Delta Rescue in your estate plans. So remember, 100% of your donations go directly to the animals of the Delta Rescue Super Sanctuary. All you need to do to find out more, go to deltarescue.org/Laura. Again, deltarescue.org/Laura. Amazing people doing amazing things. And remember, talk to them about your estate contribution. Give a contribution now. You'll never regret it. Just check out the website. It'll make you smile. Good stuff. Dr. Wilfred Riley, thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate it. A lot of other tidbits that have popped up that are very important, and some, again, reminding us that the Supreme Court is usually going to disappoint even when you feel like you've won. And I say that because big case was handed down today at the Supreme Court about the constitutionality of the Peace Cross in Bladensburg, Maryland, which has been ruled constitutionally permissible, but not on a broader religious liberty understanding or rationale, but based on a narrower and a more narrowly tailored understanding of the fact that the cross has been there for a long time, right? And
yes,
it doesn't generally offend people, and it's non-sectarian.
And it's caused no difficulties, and they're trying to say
that's a really stupid way of coming. That's Alito, right?
Well,
I got to read the whole opinion. Alito's really smart, so he must not have had the votes to do a big sweeping decision on religious liberty.
Well, what we're seeing, I think, again, and
it's the establishment clause. It's not free exercise, obviously.
And you, more than anyone, would know the dynamics of this Supreme Court. John Roberts likes consensus. He doesn't like close votes. So what that lends itself to are constant narrow readings of all of these cases that only really apply to one little shard of the case. So there's really no constitutional legs, no precedent that you can really point to with any surety, because everything is kind of a compromise. I'll read this bit. This is Sam Alito. The cross is undoubtedly a Christian symbol, but that fact should not blind us to everything else that the Bladensburg cross has come to represent. For some, that monument is a symbolic resting place for ancestors who never returned home. For others, it's a place for the community to gather to honor all veterans and their sacrifices to our nation.
That's good. See, maybe we're mischaracterizing this a little bit. I mean, I think what he's trying to do is say he has the Lemon test. It's called the Lemon versus Kurtzman absurd test that Justice Scalia ridiculed so many times at the court, which said that the predominant purpose of whatever act, or in this case, this Peace Cross, can't be sectarian. It can't be a purely sectarian, advancing a religious purpose.
So what he's doing is broadening the symbolism of the cross. He says it's undoubtedly a Christian symbol, but then he says, for some, it's a monument to a symbolic resting place. For others, it's a historical landmark. For many of the people destroying or defacing the cross that has stood undisturbed for nearly a century would not be neutral and would not further the ideals of respect and tolerance embodied in the First Amendment. That's really the heart of the ruling.
Yeah. So I want to see how he go through the Lemon test for the, because was it made on a establishment clause? That must have been, if you look at the opinion, he has to go through the classic Lemon versus Kurtzman establishment clause test. And this, this was just made up by the bench. Okay, this was in 1971 when they heard the case. They wanted to determine if a law violated the First Amendment of the Constitution, and it establishes the rule of this test for the government cannot establish religion. So, for the law to be considered constitutional under the Establishment Clause of the First Amendment, according to the Lemon v. Kurtzman test, one, it must have a legitimate secular purpose.
Right.
Number two, not have the primary effect of either advancing or inhibiting religion, which obviously doesn't have. Mm-hmm. And three, not result in any excessive entanglement of government and religion. So the court just made this test up from the bench because they were dealing with all these challenges. So, like, well, let's make up our own test. That's how they kind of did it. And so they apply every Establishment Clause case to that test. So every fact, every circumstance, every symbol.
Here's a problem this is reading from the ruling itself. This is Alito. At least four considerations show that retaining established religiously expressive monuments, symbols, and practices is quite different from erecting or adopting new ones.
That's bad.
That's not good.
That's bad. So
that means
it's all a museum now.
Right.
It's all a museum.
So
we can't have any new Christian symbols anymore.
So your grandparents could build a monument, but I can't go build one now to the people coming back from Afghanistan. I can't put that in a public traffic zone, a big Latin cross with the names of the Navy SEALs who died last week.
That's outrageous.
That's basically what it's saying here. First, these cases often show concern monuments, symbols, practices that were established long ago. And thus identifying the original purpose or purposes may be especially difficult. Then he cites all the cases. But he says this cross is closely linked to World War I, that it reflected the people and the times and the belief
so
of the time.
Maybe 50 years from now, we'll have, you know, different
pagans,
religious symbols.
And you won't be able to have any
symbolism? Or you'll have
symbolism.
Maybe if other religions take precedence over Christianity, maybe the court can... It could say it's okay because now we have a different makeup of the country. I mean, I think this is ridiculous.
He says here, memorials took the place of gravestones for those parents and other relatives who lacked the means to travel to Europe to visit the graves of their war dead. Similarly, memorials and monuments honoring important historical figures, e.g. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., often include a symbol of the faith that was important to the persons whose lives are commemorated. Finally, the World War I monuments have endured through the years and become a familiar part of the physical and cultural landscape. Requiring their removal or alteration would not be viewed by many as a neutral act. And he goes on to say, few would say that California is attempting to convey a religious message by retaining the many city names like Los Angeles, San Diego, given by the original Spanish settlers. It would be something else entirely if the state undertook to change those names. Much the same is true of these monuments and the soldier to the soldiers who sacrificed their lives for the country a century ago. This is you're really splitting the baby here, but he's saying for many, destroying or defacing the cross would not be neutral and would not further the ideals of respect and tolerance. The Lemon test. Ambitiously attempted to fashion a test for all establishment court cases. The test called on courts to examine the purposes and effects of the challenged government action. The expectation of a ready framework has not been met, and the court has many times either expressly declined to apply the
test.
Or
okay,
simply
yeah.
ignored it.
Yeah, well, Justice Scalia thought the whole thing should be just ditched. And I know Justice Thomas and his concurring opinions, and I'm interested if he concurred in this with a separate opinion.
Here is Thomas.
Oh, can we read? Let's do a dramatic reading of Justice.
You don't want me to do it.
Because he has
Justice,
such a good baritone.
The text of history of the clause, which reads, I better not. The text in the history of the clause, which reads, Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion, suggests that it should not be incorporated against the states. When the court incorporated the clause in Everson versus Board of Education of Ewing, it apparently did not consider that an incorporated establishment clause would prohibit exactly what the text of the clause seeks to protect, state establishments of religion. Mm-hmm. The appropriate question is whether any longstanding right of citizenship restrains the states in the establishment context. Further confounding the incorporation question is the fact that the First Amendment by its terms applies only to laws enacted by Congress. Quote, even if the clause applied to state and local governments in some fashion, the mere presence of the monument along the path involves no actual legal coercion. The plaintiff claiming an unconstitutional establishment of religion must demonstrate that he actually was coerced by government to conduct that shares the characteristics of an establishment as understood at the founding. Respondents have not demonstrated that maintaining a religious display on public property shares any of the historical characteristics of an establishment of religion.
You see how much better Thomas's concurrence is? Do you see how much clearer? He always does this. He agrees with the majority, but then he says, okay, this is the rationale that should be used, which is much clearer. That's why I don't want him to retire.
He says the Bladensburg cross is constitutional, even though the cross has religious significance. Religious displays or speech need not be limited to those considered non-sectarian. Mm. Insisting otherwise is inconsistent with this nation's history and traditions, and would force the court to, quote, act as supervisors or censors of religious speech, which is quoting from the majority opinion. The plurality rightly rejects the relevance of the test set forth in Lemon versus Kurtzman to claims like this one, which involve religiously expressive monuments, symbols, displays, or similar practices. But Justice Thomas would take the logical next step and overrule the Lemon Test in all contexts. So that's where he is.
Well, he is.
He says the Lemon Test has no basis in the original meaning of the Constitution.
It doesn't. It was just made up. It's like Roe versus Wade. It's the penumbras and emanations from the Constitution. It's all of the BS, I'm sorry, that these liberal, evolving legal thinkers foist upon our nation to advance a social agenda that the Congress can't get past. And that's what it's about.
Laura, I want your reaction to this. Justice Gorsuch says the American Humanist Association claims that its members come into regular, unwelcome contact with the Bladensburg Cross when they drive through the area. But this offended observer theory has no basis or standing in the law. To establish standing to sue consistent with the Constitution, a plaintiff must show injury in fact, causation, and redressability. The injury in fact must be concrete and particularized. And he goes on.
Oh my God, that is just really unbelievable. A great, great podcast. I'm so glad you guys all joined us. I want to thank all of our sponsors, Genucel, Delta Animal Rescue, and Cerovital. They're all supporting the show among so many others. Remember, America now and forever, the Laura Ingraham Podcast. See you next time.
It was a crime no one expected, and one many can't forget. 22 Hours, an American Nightmare. A new podcast from WTOP News and Podcast One details the heinous murders of a D.C. power couple, their 10-year-old son, and housekeeper inside their own home. The chilling messages from the victims being held hostage.
Hey, Nelly, it's Saba.
The complicated trail of evidence and shocking moments from the trial.
She thinks she knows how Darren Wink got inside the house.
His defense team drops a bombshell.
Will this investigation lead to the release of confidential audio recordings from the case?
So it's under general counsel review. I mean, I'm committing to making a transparent court.
22 Hours, an American Nightmare. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts today.